of Washington, Court of Appeals, Division 1, Crown Session, the Honorable Michael J. Trahee presiding.
Good morning, all. Please be seated. Since everybody's here, we're going to start a little early. First case on our March 2nd calendar is State versus Threadgill.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Koch here on behalf of Mr. Threadgill. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for a little, please. Thank you. It's my intention, subject to the court's preference, to talk about the speedy trial issue and then, time permitting, briefly mention the Gauthier issue, too. I'm not going to go through all the details of what happened when. This court already knows from our briefing. But I think it's important to understand that the speedy trial error in this case is born out of a tactical error on the part of prosecutors. As prosecutors conceded at the November 7th, 2011 hearing on their motion to continue, they were aware that the defense was going to be targeting Mr. Calvin Davis and going after him and arguing that he had something to do with the murder of Jennifer Wallstrom. That was not a surprise to them. And they would have known that based on the discovery request, based on the direction of the interviews of witnesses and so forth. So they admitted they knew that. I suspect they didn't care a whole lot, though, at least through October 17th, 2011. October 17th, 2011 is when they expected to get the DNA results for Mr. Threadgill. And I also expect that they believed that, based on the nature of how Ms. Wallstrom was killed, that that DNA evidence would show that Mr. Threadgill's DNA was on the victim's body. So the defense was okay with going after Mr. Davis. That was all fine. They were going to have their DNA evidence on October 17th, which was going to make proving Mr. Threadgill's guilt much easier. What happened, though, on that date is the DNA evidence showed that Mr. Threadgill was not a match for anything on there. It was only after that that the state then requested a DNA sample from Mr. Davis and then October 31st sent it into the lab. A few days later, they received a briefing from the defense, the trial briefing. And it was the first time, I think, that prosecutors got a picture of what the defense planned on doing at trial, even though they knew they were going after Mr. Davis, because it presented a coherent and somewhat compelling argument as to why Mr. Davis had an MO, why he had a motive, certainly had the opportunity to kill Ms. Wallstrom. And I think they panicked a little bit, realizing that they had made a mistake in not taking this particular line of defense more seriously. And it was at that point, even though they had previously told the court that the DNA results from Mr. Davis were not going to hold up the trial, that they said, we don't think it's fair that you make us go forward. We think it would be irresponsible. Therefore, we're not going to do it.
With regard to the legal standard we apply, so Cawthron just sort of cursory sort of seems, you know, they need more evidence. We'll give them a continuance. They hardly even discuss it in that case. But aren't we bound by Cawthron?
Well, Cawthron seems to be devoid of detail. It's really impossible to know what the circumstances are. You know, Cawthron, and there's other cases too, you know, Osborne, Flynn, there's certainly cases that indicate where there's a need under some circumstances to do some additional testing or wait for additional results. That may be good cause for a continuance, but it's going to depend on the circumstances of each case. The problem with this particular case is that the circumstances that were argued by the state and accepted by the court simply are not supported by the record. There are essentially two of them. The first was that the state wouldn't have known that they needed these test results on Mr. Davis until they received the state's or the defense briefing. But there was nothing new in that defense briefing. This is the same information everybody had. They just hadn't seen it portrayed perhaps so convincingly. But there was nothing new there at all. So it's not true that they couldn't have recognized the need for this testimony or this evidence much earlier. The second ground was that they essentially had been diligent. The court said the taking of the DNA sample could not reasonably have occurred earlier. But this also is not true. The state had to concede that they had never actually asked for a sample from Mr. Davis. They had certainly talked to Mr. Davis's defense attorney at the time, David Gerke. And while Mr. Gerke was not going to let them question Mr. Davis about the events surrounding the 2011 crime, because he had this pending motion for a new trial in the 2010 case, as Mr. Gerke set out in his affidavit, and it remains unrefuted, he would have advised Mr. Davis to go ahead and give a DNA sample because in his mind there was no reason not to. Mr. Davis had been a convicted felon since back in the 90s. They already had a DNA profile for him. He'd already given samples in the past, so why not? Particularly when you're trying to negotiate some resolution for the 2010 case and you can help the state out a little bit, go ahead and do it. Can't talk to him, but the DNA sample, sure, there's no problem.
And what was the date? Does Gerke pin down the date that he thought that that would have been a reasonable time to have that conversation?
I think he doesn't discuss any specific dates. I think the tone of it is that any time would have been fine. There wouldn't have been any reason to oppose it. So whenever the state came and asked us, it would have been fine. But then going back to what I originally started with, the problem wasn't Mr. Gerke, it wasn't Mr. Davis, it's that the state was putting, I think, all their eggs in one basket with his DNA testing October 17th. That's the reason, I suspect, that they never even asked.
You cite Adamski in other cases about a due diligence requirement. Is there a due diligence requirement in the case law for the current version of 3.3 continuous?
I can't say that there clearly is. And, you know, the state cites Bible, and Bible does seem to address that. But what I can tell you is that everybody seems to agree that diligence is certainly one of the factors that you look at. And I think even more importantly, where it's one of the factors that's relied upon by the trial court, then it necessarily has to be supported by the record. And that's essentially what we have here from the trial court is a diligence finding. The taking of the DNA sample could not reasonably have occurred earlier. But it's completely undercut by the evidence in this record. Most certainly could have been taken earlier. And it's just, you know, if I were a trial attorney asking for an extension of time and I went in there and said, Judge, we thought we were ready, but now I've looked at the state's trial brief. This is pretty compelling. The way they've laid this out, I'm going to need more time. I would expect that the question I would get is, well, what's new here, counsel? And if there's really nothing new, then there's no ground for a continuance. And I think that's exactly what happened in this case. The state didn't want to proceed, but they should have been forced to proceed. And it shouldn't have been Mr. Threadgill's rights to a speedy trial that had to give way to sort of let the state out of the jam that they themselves created by not acting on this evidence much earlier in the case. Unless the court has any questions about that, the only thing I'll say about Gauthier, I think it's covered in our briefing, is that, you know, this is not the typical Gauthier issue. In most cases, it's going to be like Gauthier Jones, where I think the state uses closing argument to sort of comment that is invite the jury to infer something bad based on the invocation of a Fourth Amendment right. But the cases don't say that that's the only way that you can have a comment. And in this case, we had multiple witnesses, three witnesses. We had their expert. We also had two detectives, their forensic investigator and two detectives, all making this distinction between, you know, Mr. Davis on the one hand, who by the time of trial nobody was going after as the culprit anymore, who just said, here's my phone, go ahead and you know, take what you need and look at it, versus the other two individuals, Ms. McMillan Cooper, who clearly had some fault in this case, had already pled guilty, and Mr. Davis, who for whom they had to go in front of a judge and get a warrant to get this. And it's that contrast, that direct contrast, that would have invited jurors to conclude that Mr. Davis had something to hide. Otherwise, why the necessity of going out there and having to get the warrant and going to a judge? So in effect, it's the same as if the state had said something about this in closing argument. It still would have had the same impact on jurors. Unless the court has any questions, I'll go ahead and reserve my final 2 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Amy Meckling appearing on behalf of the State of Washington in this matter. Mr. Koch speculates about what the state's tactical reasons for not specifically asking for Mr. Davis's DNA beforehand aside. I don't think it's at all clear from the record that the state was aware that this is the route that the defense was taking with Mr. Davis, just based on their interviews and the facts of the case itself. Mr. Davis was not a viable suspect in this case to the state's mind. He had no motive. He had no reason to kill the victim. They were on good terms. But what he did have was very valuable information about the motivation that the co-defendant, Araya McMillan Cooper, and the defendant as well, may have had to kill the victim. So we definitely wanted to speak to him. I think that's clear. With respect to his attorney's declaration and saying, well, I wouldn't let you speak to him, but I would have let you have this DNA sample had you only asked for it. It's a little bit disingenuous to say that when you look at the facts of the case, Mr. Davis's case. Mr. Davis had been charged with these very serious crimes before the murder even occurred. he had lost at trial, and the state was seeking an exceptional sentence above the standard range for him. He had a motion for a new trial pending that had some legitimate issues, and he was hoping for the state to abandon its request for an exceptional sentence, and so he wasn't cooperating with us in an attempt to get this deal and broker this deal. I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say, well, you didn't ask me for the DNA sample, I would have provided that. And if you notice, Mr. Gerke's declaration is devoid of any information about what he was asked or when. And the prosecutor was very clear in the motion for a new trial that he had told her to essentially pound sand when she asked to interview him until his case was resolved.
What about on the 17th of October, once the state knew that Threadgill's DNA could not be found on the victim? Don't you think it would have been a reasonable effort at that point to say, well, who else should we talk to?
Sure, and then that's why, and then the state certainly, I mean, I'm not saying the state didn't want Mr. Davis's DNA. I think we did. And when he was sentenced on October 19, so that's 2 days later, Mr. Gerke allowed us to interview him and take a reference sample from him the next week, October 28, and that's when we submitted it to the crime lab. On November 1st, at the omnibus hearing, which is 1 day later, that's when the state comes in and says, we've now got the sample, we have given it to the crime lab, and I hope it's back by the 7th. We start trial, but, you know, honestly, we're going to proceed without it because, to our way of thinking, he's not a particularly viable suspect, which apparently was borne out because the defense didn't really go that route at trial either, if you'll notice. But on November 3, 2 days after the omnibus hearing, after the state has said on the record, we're ready to go whether we have this analysis back from the lab or not, that's when Mr. Threadgill filed this 100-page, brief attaching copies of prior police reports involving Mr. Davis, outlining all of his prior bad acts and how they were going to attack him as the suspect. I don't think it was at all clear to the state prior to that point in time that they were going to essentially put all their eggs in this basket and hammer Mr. Davis at trial. And that's when Ms. Carlstrom said, I was ready to go before, but I don't think that that's fair to make us proceed at this point in time, knowing that that's how they're going to attack this case. And at the motion to continue, at the motion to continue, I think it was Judge Roberts, it wasn't the trial judge. Judge Roberts did not just, if you read the transcript, she didn't just sit back and say, okay, whatever you need, state, go ahead and have it. She questioned the parties extensively about what had happened in this case. And she,
well, I agree. I've read the transcript, and she seems to be talking about the diligence of the state. Is there a due diligence requirement?
There's not it's not an explicit requirement like Mr. Koch has acceded here at argument today that that's in the rule itself, CRR 3.3. But I think it's fair to say that certainly when the state is asking for a continuance based on something that it needs and something that it needs to do, its diligence is certainly a factor that the court should consider when exercising its discretion to grant the continuance.
And in the order, and in her oral ruling, she basically says the state was as diligent as it could be.
Yes. And
is that a finding of fact, or what is that for purposes of our appellate review?
Well, I don't think this isn't like a motion to suppress where there's findings of facts and they need to be supported by substantial evidence of the record, but it's a de novo review once you find those facts are met. It's an abuse of discretion standard. It's not a de novo standard of review. It's an abuse of discretion. And so you're talking about facts that are before the trial judge.
What about cases like Adamski and I think there's a Division I case by Judge Agate after that, which sort of reads a diligence requirement in. Is that the test, or is it Cawthorn, which basically says if you need the evidence, go get it and we'll continue it?
Well, I don't think that I would agree that Cawthorn doesn't have a lot of detail about what exactly was needed. And I think that when you're looking at this case from an appellate standpoint, you can't just look at Cawthorn and say, okay, the state needed it, so that's good enough. No speedy trial violation. I mean, that's not your role. You need to look at specific facts that are in the record here and make a determination whether this judge abused her discretion and whether any reasonable judge would have made the finding that she did. I also want to point out just really briefly, I'm not sure that this is a concern for the court, but by law, the state has no access to Mr. Davis's DNA profile in CODIS. There's no, by law, there is no identifying information attached to any convicted offender profile in CODIS. There's no way we could have pulled his DNA profile out
so
of there.
So you would have required
used
a new DNA sample from
Absolutely. And I can give you the WAC and the Code of Federal Regulation, and I can give you all of that if you need it. But just suffice it to say, that's not possible. The prosecutor stated that wasn't possible with the motion to continue, and that is legally accurate. So we did not have access to his DNA. We could not have gotten a court order for his DNA because he was not a suspect in the crime. There was no probable cause to take his DNA. We needed his consent. He was using his pending case as leverage with us, and I think that it's fair to say when the prosecutor didn't say, when she said she did not necessarily need his DNA to go forward with trial, that was prior to Mr. Threadgill's extensive briefing about how he planned to use Mr. Davis as a suspect in the case. And I will note that at the motion to continue, Judge Roberts questioned the defense about that and said, well, this seems a little bit like sandbagging, because on just 2 days earlier, on November 1, you heard the state say, well, we've now got it, we've submitted it, but we're going to go forward without it. And then you file this brief saying, we're going to put all our eggs in this basket and focus on him because you know they're not going to have his DNA probably. Is that fair? I mean, she did point that out, and I don't think that that's – I'm not trying to argue that's what Mr. Threadgill was intentionally doing, but that's a concern that the state was – that the court was looking at. Judge Roberts gave very careful consideration to the evidence that was before her, the facts that were before her on the motion to continue, and I don't believe that an appellate court can say that her decision was an abuse of discretion based on this record. Does the court have any questions about the Gauthier issue? I'm happy to talk about that briefly if you have any questions about it. Okay. And then thank you very much. I would ask the court to affirm Mr. Threadgill's conviction for first-degree murder and his exceptional sentence. Thank you.
So in response to the argument that it's disingenuous to say that they would have gotten a sample, I think Mr. Gerke's affidavit speaks for itself. And while it's true what the state says, that by law they apparently needed a fresh sample, they couldn't use what was already in CODIS, Mr. Gerke apparently was not aware of this. The important fact is, had they asked, they would have gotten exactly the sample they needed, a fresh sample. So the fact that they needed a fresh sample versus something else really doesn't play into that particular analysis. Going back to the court's questions about, you know, what actually is necessary, does the state get in a continuance if they just say they need one for results? Again, you know, Cawthron is not very revealing, and I think it's much more helpful to look at cases like State v. Osborne and State v. Flynn, which are discussed in our briefing, because I think those cases show what actual diligence, actual necessity, actual surprise looks like. In each of those cases, there wasn't a strategic error on the part of the state. They did everything they should have done, and they did it in a timely manner. Yet despite doing that, there was some hitch, whether it's because it was complicated analysis, whether it's because they got very late notice of a new defense that they had no knowledge of whatsoever. Those are the sorts of circumstances where it's reasonable and the record supports the state getting a continuance, even where the defendant objects. But in this case, where the state already knew and they admitted this in the hearing on their motion to continue, they knew that the defense was going after Mr. Davis. It's not a fair statement of the record that they were caught off guard by this. They should have taken it more seriously, but that's the state's problem. It shouldn't be Mr. Threadgill's. Unless the court has any questions, I'll conclude by asking you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.